Good morning. Thank you for being here so much. It's always good for me anyway to get back into the swing of things. We had our gospel meeting last week with Brother John Gibson, and I want to put to rest right away before we get too far down this road this rumor that apparently has started around that I decided to preach a sermon called Bad Company this morning because the Gibsons spent a week in my house last week. That is not true, has no bearing in truth whatsoever. They were the very epitome of good company, as it happens. This is a different kind of company that we're going to be talking about today. The well-known British rocker Paul Rodgers said one time in an interview that in his days before he got really, really famous, when he was putting a band together and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do with it and what it was going to be called, he happened upon an old Victorian morals book, one of those old things that circulated in England trying to teach children how they were supposed to be. And in that book, there was a picture of a young, impressionable lad looking up at a disreputable sort of fellow leaning against a lamppost, clearly about to cause trouble for anyone who he might be able to cause trouble for. And the caption for the picture read, "Beware of bad company." And Paul, being the dyed-in-the-wool rocker that he was, said, "That sounds like a pretty good name for our band, Bad Company." And that's what he called the band, and that's what they pursued, as rockers typically do. And this is not an anti-rock and roll sermon necessarily here today, but there's no doubt that there is a considerable portion of that community that is heavily invested in plumbing the depths of human degradation, let's just put it that way, and encouraging other people to do the same thing. And so it's not necessarily a poor choice of terminology for a rock and roll band. I don't think that the book, or at least I don't know that the book, had specific reference to the text in 1 Corinthians 15:33, to which we'll be referring today. I'm quite confident that Mr. Rodgers didn't have reference to it. But nevertheless, that's what we're going to be focusing on today, and focusing on it in the context in which it is found. And I want to say before we get going here this morning that 1 Corinthians 15:33 very well may be the most consistently taken out of context verse in the Bible, at least in my experience anyway, among my brethren. That includes me personally. I have in my lifetime heard this passage referred to I don't know how many hundreds of times, and virtually every single one of them took the passage out of context. Now, I think they were true to the general meaning of the context. I think that bad company corrupts good morals, or however your version may translate it, is what we might call an adage or a proverb that appears to have not been original to Paul. And the many Bibles, including the New American Standard Bible, put the phrase in quotation marks, like he's quoting from something. And sometimes Paul's letters read like that he's quoting from some previous material. It may very well be that he is quoting from some kind of proverb of the day and applying it in a specific context. But he does apply it in a context. And before we get to the sermon that you're expecting me to preach here from this text, I want to talk about a little bit what it does mean in its context and discuss what company we might be keeping as we go about our daily walk as Christians. In the immediate context of 1 Corinthians 15, I think it would have to be understood that doctrinal company really is what is in view, not social company or moral or other kind of a behavioral company, but rather the company that is kept with people who teach the truth or do not, in fact, teach the truth. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, you're probably aware, if you know the context very well at all, 1 Corinthians is an odd kind of book. It's not a thematic kind of book like Romans or Ephesians or Hebrews. It's basically a collection of many letters Paul is addressing a bunch of problems that he knows about, and then he addresses a bunch of problems that he's found out about. And then eventually he is going to ask them to address a problem that they don't, that's new, the problem of the needy saints in Jerusalem, and he deals with that in chapter 16. The very last argument that he deals with, though, is in chapter 15, and that's about the resurrection. And as you might expect, Paul does not go out of his way to detail for us the false doctrine that apparently was being spread at that point. We can kind of put two and two together and figure out the nuts and bolts of it, at least. It appears that there were some people who were teaching that the resurrection, as we understand it, the future resurrection, our bodily resurrection at the conclusion of things physical, that this would not take place. That whatever resurrection was promised to the people of God had already taken place. And Paul goes to great lengths in 1 Corinthians 15 to argue that the resurrection is part and parcel with our existence as a Christian. That it goes back all the way to the resurrection of Jesus Christ and how that prefigures our own resurrection. In other contexts, he talks about the spiritual implications that that has for us, the resurrection of Jesus. But he says in 1 Corinthians 15, it's not just that. It's not just that you are reborn in Jesus and raised up to walk in newness of life, like he writes in Romans chapter 6. There is actually a new life, a different life, that is going to be given to you with a different kind of body, in a different kind of place, and a very, very different kind of surrounding. And that is assured to us because Jesus has been raised from the dead. And he argues here in this context that we need to have confidence in this resurrection. And in fact, if we do not have confidence in the resurrection, then what are we doing here? What point does any of this serve? Let's go ahead and eat, drink, and for tomorrow we die, as he says here. Another adage that he's quoting from the day with a somewhat less principled underpinning. There is going to be a resurrection. And it is in this context, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, that right in the middle of this discussion, seemingly out of nowhere, he gives us this phrase that we're quoting here today. Bad company corrupts good morals. In verse number 33. And there's a lot in this context in 1 Corinthians 15 that we're not going to be able to get to. This is not a resurrection context. Not a resurrection sermon. But I do want to emphasize here that we, if we are going to be the people of God, we have to be able to stand for the truth. Not just the truth of the resurrection, but all truth. That we as the people of God are required to take a stand for what is right. And that implies, of course, correctly implies, that there is going to be opportunity for us to believe something else. There are going to be people who come along who have a different notion. And who are going to try to teach us something other than what Jesus has tried to teach us. And generally speaking, it comes down to a person's own personal preferences based on his own personal carnal needs. If you are invested wholly in this life, if this life is all that there is to you, if you're not really concerned very much about heaven, then it kind of stands to reason that you would seek out for yourself a gospel or a philosophy or whatever that would enhance your life here on earth, because after all, the life here on earth is all you've got as far as you're concerned. And so we read in passages such as 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 3 and 4, "For the time will come when they," that is the people who would listen to Timothy preach, "for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth, and will turn aside to myths." Now notice here this idea of in accordance with your own with their own desires. They have their own idea about what truth is. And that truth caters to their own personal desires, he says here. And because of that, they're going to turn away their ears from the truth. They're going to turn aside to myths. Things that don't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. Things that certainly are not grounded in God's truth. Otherwise, they would be God's truth. But they service these people's own carnal needs. And so, therefore, it's attractive. They like it. It puts money in their pocket. It puts food on their plate. It puts friends in their own personal company. Whatever it happens to be. We are warned in numerous places about such ones, and we're instructed on how we're supposed to deal with them. I'll refer you to 3 John, the third epistle of John, and verses number 9 and 10. And a man named Diotrephes, who's rather infamous among our brethren, and rightfully so, John wrote here, I wrote something to the church. There was apparently some kind of letter that he wrote. Maybe this has reference to 1 John or 2 John or perhaps another letter. I wrote something to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first among them, does not accept what we say. For this reason, if I come, I will call attention to his deeds, which he does, unjustly accusing us with wicked words, and is not satisfied with this. He himself does not receive the brethren either. And he forbids those who desire to do so and puts them out of the church. Now, you might wonder why a person's in the church at all if they are, A, opposed to the teachings of the apostles, and B, trying hard to kick anybody out of the assembly who thinks otherwise. It seems like you just start your own club or something like that. That'd be a better way to go. But these people are at least holding some form of attachment to Jesus Christ, but it does not have its root in the apostles. And John condemns this one, not only for having that attitude, but also forcing it on other people. This attitude is false. And I mean false in the purest sense of the word, not just incorrect, but fake. An imitation. He looks like a Christian. He looks like a gospel preacher, or perhaps a gospel elder, but he is not that. He is putting on a facade. He is not truly devoted to Jesus Christ. He's devoted to himself. And if we run across such ones, whether in the pulpit or anywhere else, if this one is making himself the center of attention, if he is making himself the focus of all things, to the exclusion of the message of Jesus Christ, this one is to be rejected. Because he's not standing for the truth. Likewise, and kind of the flip side of that same coin, there are some people who will not oppose error. Now, what's the distinction? Well, sometimes it's kind of blurry, the line between the two, but I want to make a point of saying both of these things, because there are some people in this world who claim to be Christians, who claim to be teachers of God's word, who are all about standing for the truth. They are determined, in fact, to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ, or at least parts of it, to tell people about Jesus and build up Jesus and glorify Jesus in their words and in their lives and that sort of thing. But when it comes to the opposition, when it comes to those who are not in accordance with God's will, with behaviors from the outside and behaviors on the inside, as far as that goes, that are not in accordance with God's will, they're strangely silent about that. Yes, we'll stand for the truth, but we're not especially interested in opposing error. What we need to understand is if we are going to stand for the truth, that necessarily means we must oppose error. Therefore, there should not be a difference between these two, whether or not we want to make a difference between them. There is no real difference because those who are standing for the truth are, by their very nature, opposing error. And I can turn to various passages, but I'll refer you to Titus chapter 1, where the duties of an elder and the responsibilities of an elder, the qualities, character of an elder, are being described. Part of that is that they are to be holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. Now, you notice there's two reasons for understanding the Bible. There's two reasons for studying the Bible. Put it into work in your life. You want to exhort them in sound doctrine. You want to be able to teach people the right thing and build them up in the truth. But from a practical standpoint, we know that the time is going to come, and it's probably not going to be very long, where we're going to be exposed to something other than the truth. Certainly out there in the world, and more than likely at some point in the confines of the local church. Well, now what are we going to do? Well, the elder has to be prepared to deal with that as well. He has to be prepared to refute this false teaching, to refute those who contradict. That's the way the New American Standard Bible reads here, at least, those who contradict. There are some people who will say, we need to do what the Bible tells us to do. And whatever it tells us to do, that's what we're going to do. And there will be some people who contradict that. No, that's not what, and it may not be quite so bold as that, but that's what it boils down to. The Bible says, oppose this particular behavior. Well, we don't want to do that. Or the Bible says that we need to be pure in a particular aspect of doctrine. No, we need to be flexible on that. I'm going to contradict you on that. Well, the one who will contradict Bible teaching is himself to be contradicted, the text says here. So as we are Christians, and we're not just talking about elders here, we're not just talking about preachers, anyone who would have good company must make sure that the company that he keeps is doctrinally sound. Make sure that the doctrine that he or she is exposed to is God's doctrine, God's teaching. And that we're in position to oppose whatever else might come down the road. Now, how might that happen? What kind of situation might, in what kind of situations might that come up? Well, various situations. And I'm going to give you a few examples of this. And largely, I'm going to leave it to you to make practical application of this. Because ultimately, that's what this is going to be. You have to take this home and decide for yourself how best to apply these truths. But I'll give you some suggestions. We are blessed or cursed, depending on the way you look at it, with a great plethora of religious books, magazines, whatnot, that are available to us in this world, especially in the United States. And there are various places that you can go, store locations, storefronts, go online to retailers that are online, and find a great deal of information out there that will, in theory at least, bring you closer to Jesus Christ. Well, as you're probably well aware, it doesn't necessarily work that way. Because every book that you're going to run across, except for this one right here, is written by a human being. And human beings make mistakes. Sometimes they, in fact, will intentionally mislead people. I don't want to get too much into the motives of hypothetical random writers here, but we know this to be true. And if we are going to expose ourselves to these kind of philosophies, these kind of teachings, these kind of doctrines, we need to be very careful. I'm not saying you're going to be in sin for walking into Lifeway or something like that. That's not my point at all. Nor even for buying a book there. But we do need to emphasize that just because something purports to be in harmony with God's will does not make it God's will. Just because someone quotes a lot of Bible, or maybe more often the case, quotes some Bible, occasionally quotes Bible, refers to the Bible, that doesn't necessarily mean they are espousing sound doctrine. We need to be careful about this. And I'm on a bit of a rampage as far as this goes. I do not understand our brethren who will spend the Lord's money out of the church treasury to support the work of people who do not stand for the truth. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's sinful. I've done it myself as an individual from time to time, and I'm sure many of you have as well. But do we really want to be supportive and encouraging and financially supportive of people who do not teach the truth, who in fact teach error from time to time? They may not overtly teach error in the actual book that we buy. I hope not, anyway. But is it really appropriate for us to give them the same kind of fellowship that we would give to our brethren? Is it reasonable to assume that we can keep company with people who teach error, who are known to teach error, or at the very least, known not to teach the whole gospel, and think that it won't rub off on us? The same thing can go for the internet, more so for the internet. If I can put out a website, anybody can put out a website. You don't need any kind of special degrees. You don't need any kind of education. You don't need to open up the Bible as far as that goes. You can put anything out there. And if you want to find some weird, knothead, half-baked philosophy about how to study the Bible or what a particular passage means, you can find pretty much whatever you want to find out there on the internet. I would like to think that we are astute enough and introspective enough to realize just because it's in print or on a computer screen doesn't make it true, that we need to examine these things ourselves. And I'll mention commentaries as well. Some of you have been in my office and you've seen a couple of walls full of commentaries. I have maybe not as many as some preachers, more than some, fewer than others. I read them every once in a while. Maybe you do too, and that's fine. But I trust that we realize that these people who are more educated than me, who probably spent more time in the book than I have, that doesn't mean they're teaching the truth. That doesn't mean that they are correct in the things that they espouse. You read your commentaries, fine. That's absolutely appropriate. You can do that. But take into mind that this is the work of a human being. A human being that may or may not have the truth on any individual subject, and who almost certainly has been wrong on some subject at some point. We do not give approval to this person in the same way that we give approval to the Bible. If we get to a point where we trust a blog, or we trust a commentary, or we trust a bookstore or whatever, to the point where we just assume that if it came from source X, it must be true, we need to rethink the way that we're keeping company. That is not the way that God would have us behave by any stretch of the imagination. Realizing especially that many of these places are determined to take you away from the truth of God's word and not bring you closer to it. Well, let me give you a second point along the same kind of lines. We can very definitely be guilty in our culture of keeping bad philosophical company. And by philosophical, I mean to take a bit of a step away from the notion of doctrine. We're not talking about what's in the Bible necessarily, but rather ways of looking at the world, ways of looking at life that may seem on the surface to really not have a whole lot to do with the Bible, have a whole lot to do with Jesus Christ. But when it comes down to it, they do, in fact, bear on our ability to walk with Christ. I'll give you a few examples of this. There are some philosophies that diminish the importance of human life. We could talk about abortion, we could talk about evolution, we could talk about a number of things that basically say that although the Bible says that we are made in the image of God, that we as human beings are made after His image, created by Him for His purposes, that in fact, human life is not especially sacred. At least in certain contexts, it's not. And that the taking of life is, you know, a personal choice or whatever you want to call it. I would refer you, among other passages, to Genesis chapter 9, verse number 5 and 6, where upon disembarking the ark, Noah is told there about capital punishment. He's told there that life is in the blood, and that if a man is guilty of shedding blood, he himself is to have his blood shed. In fact, I'd like to use the exact terminology if you haven't already turned over. Genesis chapter 9, verse number 5 and 6 reads, "Surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood by man, his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, he made man." Now, there's some interesting terminology there that I want to focus on that you may not have seen before, that I may not have appreciated before. Whoever sheds man's blood by man, his blood shall be shed. All right, sin makes a person worthy of death. We see that in numerous places, Old and New Testament alike. If you're a Christian, presumably you sign on with that. The question comes up, why is it then, if someone has committed a crime so heinous that not only is their soul lost, but they have forfeited the right to live on earth with other human beings? If such is the case, why doesn't God just kill him? He's done it before. He has the equipment. You ever seen a lightning storm? You ever known anybody struck by lightning, swallowed up by a sinkhole? People die of so-called natural causes a lot. Now, I'm not suggesting that God personally is killing all these people. That's not my point at all. My point is this. If God saw someone who committed murder and determined in His judgment that that person was worthy of death, God could kill him if He wanted to. That's not the rule that He set up. He said, by man His blood shall be shed. And it strikes me that that is done on purpose. That God is not just emphasizing that sin requires punishment, but also getting us involved in the process. helping us to realize this is how important life is, that only in situations like this is it appropriate for us to take life. If a person shows such disrespect for life, he has forfeited this life. Now, there are some people who will deny this concept, and I don't want to get into a big capital punishment discussion here. I think there's room for us to differ on points of policy on these matters. But I do think that if you have a circumstance where someone is suggesting that if you're 80 years old in poor health, you should take a little pill and say goodbye to your loved ones, and that be the end of the story, that is vile. That is contrary to everything that we know in the Bible. And I'm not making stuff up. This has been a philosophy that's been widely espoused for a very long time and that is catching on very much in the modern day. Just pulling number 80 out of a hat. But do we truly value human life? A diminishing respect for authority. We are told that we are supposed to render to all what is due. In terms of our relationships with government and such, tax to whom tax is due, custom to custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now, you may have problem working up honor and respect for civil government. I wouldn't necessarily blame you for that. I have my degree of contempt as well. Nevertheless, we are told, in the context, by the way, of a very vile and tyrannical government, speaking to a group of Christians that is living in the belly of the beast there in Rome, render to whom what is due. We still regard authority. And I think that there's a variety of reasons for that, but one of them is this. If we get in the habit of deciding when it's okay, pardon me, to reject authority, when it's okay for us to just, well, I don't feel like doing what the boss said. I don't feel like doing what mom and dad said. I don't feel like doing what the sheriff said. I'm going to do this other thing instead. We set up a precedent that is going to have ripple effects in our life, and that cannot help but bear on our relationship with God. How many times have we known this to be the case, where permissive parents allow the children to run the show? You know, little Timmy, I want you to do this. Well, I don't want to do that. Oh, okay. As long as we're agreed on that. Well, who's running the show here? Well, little Timmy's running the show. And then little Timmy turns 16 years old, and mom and dad wonder why he hasn't given himself over to Jesus Christ yet. And they say, why haven't you done that? I don't want to. Well, Jesus told you to do it. Well, I don't care. Why should he care? He's been told he doesn't have to care about authority. He can do whatever he wants to do. There is a very real question authority kind of mentality among some. And I'm aware that by submitting to certain authorities, we can reject higher, greater authorities. I'm aware of that. In that sense, yes, question authority. I'm not saying you give yourself over to government just because it's government and doesn't have any bearing on your soul or your salvation. That's not what I'm saying. Our commitment to God has to come first. But if we have a commitment to authority, a proper commitment to authority that is born in the house, in the home, but has ripple effects onto our relationship with God, with the boss, the workplace, school, and every other relationship that we ever have. If we can respect authority, then it'll put us in position to succeed. If we are encouraged to reject authority, to rebel against authority, do whatever you want to do instead of what somebody's telling you to do, that kind of philosophy cannot help but have an impact on our relationship with Jesus Christ. There are philosophies, and this is maybe the oldest one of all, that exalt self. And all of these philosophers work in advertising, apparently. Or at least the best ones do. You know, you want to go for the... And most of them are advertising for beer, peers. Anyway, you need to go for the gusto, or you know, live the high life, or whatever it happens to be. You want to indulge yourself. And this may not come across in the commercials necessarily, but by indulging yourself, if you happen to run roughshod over somebody else, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing, but I wouldn't get too stressed out about it. You know, because ultimately, it's all about you. It's all about what you can get out of life and nothing else. Now, I would like to think that I don't need to demonstrate from the Bible how contrary to the gospel that kind of philosophy is, but I'm going to spend a little bit of time doing it. I'll refer you to Romans chapter 15, among other passages. This will do, though. Romans 15, verse number 1 through 3. And I would make a special application of this concept towards spiritual things and local church issues because, pardon me, if we're not careful, we can start thinking that being a part of a local church is all about getting whatever we want. And if somebody else doesn't give us what we want, that makes them the enemy, makes them the bad guys. And it means that we need to just kind of ignore them or marginalize them or kick them in the shins, you know, whatever works. The text says, Romans 15, verse 1, "Now we who are strong ought to bear the weaknesses of those without strength and not just please ourselves. Each of us is to please his neighbor for his good, to his edification. For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me." If Jesus had come into this world determined to serve himself first of all and us whenever we could, you know, wherever he could fit it in, he never would have gone to the cross. Couldn't possibly have gone to the cross. The most selfless act in human history, no doubt. Now, we're not going to be required, I suspect, to crucify ourselves on a cross for the benefit of brothers and sisters in Christ. That might be easier than giving up a free Saturday afternoon or helping somebody in need or doing a hospital visit or baking a pie or a dinner or something like that for somebody who's in need, whatever it happens to be. Thinking of others instead of ourselves. There is, again, a very prominent philosophy that says that is exactly the opposite of what you ought to do. You ought to think of yourself and only yourself. If that is the kind of philosophy that you embrace, kind of philosophy that you grab hold of in some secular context, don't be surprised if it winds up bleeding over into your relationship with Jesus Christ. I'll give you a few examples of this also. Television, movies, that's probably the obvious thing. There is all kinds of philosophies like vigilantism, for instance, or situation ethics that basically get the job done. Back in the day, there was Jack Bauer on 24, who did all kinds of horrible, despicable kind of things to all kinds of people, including some good people, because of the greater good. And it's just assumed that it's the right thing because he did it. Well, that is a philosophy that may make for good television or good movies. It may entertain you for an hour or for a series of hours. But if you're not careful, we can start thinking that we know better than anybody else, and so therefore we're going to do whatever we want to do, and we'll just, everybody else will figure out a way to deal with it, basically. Sports. You know, I don't watch as much sports as I used to, but and this may be one of the reasons. I get kind of tired of rationalizing in my mind why all of the rascals on my team were misunderstood or kids being kids or whatever, and all the rascals on the other teams ought to go to jail for a million years. It doesn't seem quite reasonable in a Bible setting to take a position like that. Well, it's not reasonable. It's not right. And if we're not careful, we can get so caught up in our other allegiances, our other values, our other pastimes and whatnot, that we can start adopting philosophies that are contrary to what God would have us to do. Now, before we close, let's preach the sermon that everybody was expecting me to preach when I put the slide up here about 1 Corinthians 15:13. There is a very real sense in which bad social company will corrupt good morals. The friends that you choose to keep, the associations that you choose to have and indulge in, embrace, bring close to yourself, will have an effect on you. They have to. One of the songs that Brother Powers chose for us here this morning, one of the great traditional hymns that we sing, "How Sweet, How Heavenly Is the Sight When Those Who Love the Lord, One Another's Peace, Delight, and So Fulfill the Lord, the Word." When we come together as the people of God and create this synergistic bond, a spiritual bond with one another, it apparently it lights our bosoms on fire, apparently, according to the song anyway. But I think we trust, we understand what the song is meaning there. That we grow this warmth, this association, this attachment to one another. Because we know each other, because we love each other, because we're close to one another. Now, you can get close to other people. There are lots of people in the world. There's like 8 billion people in the world. I don't know how many of them are Christians. I don't know which ones are your best friends. But it very well could be that you choose to bring into your core circle, your inner circle, people who do not share your spiritual values. It very well may be that the people that you're associating with at this level are going to interfere with your ability to serve God. In fact, I would question how that could possibly not be the case. I'm not suggesting that we leave the world. We have to be a part of things, as it were. But there are Christians who choose to attach themselves at a close, intimate level with those who do not share their values, who do not value the same kind of things that they value. And this is common knowledge. That's in the context of what Paul is meaning in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse number 14 and following. Do not be bound together with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness and lawlessness, or what fellowship has light and darkness? And he goes on talking about this connection that we have, this attachment that we have to evildoers. And generally the conversation is this talking about just marriage or talking about other stuff? Well, I think it's talking about other stuff, but that's not really the point. The point is, whether it's marriage or any other kind of relationship, you can be in a harness, a yoke, as it were, with someone who is pulling in the same direction as you, or you can be in the harness with someone who's pulling in a different direction. You are in one side of the yoke, and you want to plow in a westerly direction. Well, you got this other knucklehead in the yoke with you, and they want to pull in a north direction. Okay, well, how is that field going to look? How effectively are you going to be able to do the job that you're trying to do? Well, not very well, probably. Or maybe more literally, you have a certain shape, they have a certain shape, the yoke's all twisted. It's just not right. You have two donkeys or two horse or two oxen that are the same size, same basic strength, so they can do the same kind of work, equally yoked. If you are going to try to do God's work in this life, you need to be yoked to somebody who's trying to do God's work. And if you're yoked to someone who's trying to do something else, then you could assume safely that your work is going to be compromised. There are people who are going to be whittling away at our commitment. Those who love father or mother more than me are not worthy of me, the text says. It's not appropriate for you to value your physical relations, friends, family, whatever, at a higher level than your relationship with Jesus Christ. And the time's going to come when you're going to have to choose. You're going to have to choose between your commitment to your family or your commitment to your friends, your commitment to your job, whatever, and your commitment to Jesus. And it's not just a serious big-time decision. Which one is more important to me at this moment in my life? And if we're not able to say Jesus, then there's a very serious problem. There's going to be a tainting by association that's involved also that we need to watch out for. One of the reasons that we're not supposed to associate with a gossip is given to us in Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 19. The one who goes about around carrying tales reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with a gossip. It's not appropriate for you to be attached to someone who is going to be making you look guilty by association. I mean, who does gossip associate with, after all, except other gossips? It doesn't stand to reason the best friend of a gossip is going to be a pretty big gossip. Well, what happens if your best friend is an adulterer, or your best friend is a drunk, or your best friend is a vile person? Does it not stand to reason, to a certain extent at least, that association is going to be rubbed off on you? We're going to find these associations with friends, social media. I wrestle with this a lot. A lot of people that I'm quote-unquote friends with on Facebook do not have very strong values. What am I going to do with that? Does there come a time when I have to sever relationships with that, with those kind of people? And family too. Some of you have been in this situation where your family relationships had to be compromised, had to be severed, because that was the only way that you could serve God. We need to value these things. We need to make sure that our associations are going to be valued and appreciated. This point that I'm going to make here at the end, minimize their influence and maximize their diligence, I'll leave you with this, and then we'll close up. I appreciate your patience. This is my, in a nutshell, advice. And I don't especially like giving advice, but I'll give you this much at least. When you're associating with these people, minimize their influence, maximize your diligence. We are part of the world, and we're going to remain part of the world. That's the way it is. And to a certain extent, that's a good thing. We are told to be salt of the earth. We can't be the salt of the earth unless we're in the earth. We cannot have this seasoning effect on the world if we're not in the world. The text says in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse number 9 and 10, that he had warned them about associations, evil associations. He said, I wasn't talking about associations with the world. I'm talking about associations with Christians. If you want to get away from bad associations in the world, you're going to have to leave the world. And I don't mean like get on that crazy guy's rocket and go to the moon either, because the people on the rocket with you, they're going to be bad influences too. So you're not going to be able to get away from them there either. Yes, we are in the world, and we're going to have to remain in the world. But we have to make sure that whatever association we have with the world does not affect who we are. It does not affect our saltiness, as it were. And I mean that in a positive kind of way. That we are to do, as Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 14 through 16, that we are to be holy in all of our behavior. Because he told us, be holy as I am holy. We need to separate ourselves spiritually, morally, from the influences of the world that is around us. Only in that way can we be the people of God. This is not an easy thing to do. This is not one of those sermons where you go home saying, hey, I learned a whole bunch of stuff, and just kind of stop, and you're done. I'm going to ask you to think about these kind of things very carefully, and over an extended period of time. I would like you to revisit these things from time to time. Because testing your faith, seeing if you're in the faith, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5, that's not like the final exam in college where you pass it one time and you're done. You never have to prove that you know anything about English Lit anymore. That's not the point at all. We examine ourselves on an ongoing basis. Because we have to be in the faith on an ongoing basis. We have to be true to God's word on an ongoing basis. And it very well may be that the associations that you have today are different than the associations that you had a year ago or 5 years ago. And it may be that they're having more of an effect on you today than they had in the past. And it may be that you don't know that. The only way that you're going to know is by examining yourself. And again, exactly how you self-administer that test, that's going to be up to you. But however you do it, do it. And make sure that these attachments that you're making are not compromising your attachment to Jesus Christ. Because ultimately, that is the only friend that we will ever need, and the only friend that is going to be able to usher us into spiritual realities after this life is over. There is going to be a resurrection, like we talked about by way of introduction this morning. The righteous to a resurrection of life, the wicked to a resurrection of damnation. And we need to be on the right side of that. And the only way we can do that is by giving ourselves over to Jesus Christ completely and totally in this life. And then bearing that out with our day-to-day, week-to-week, year-to-year decisions. Whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ more perfectly today, we want to help you with that. We want to do whatever we can, including helping you into the water of baptism if that has not been the case in your situation before. If you can give yourself over to Jesus Christ today, if you can start living for Jesus this very day, more than for anything else, more than for SEC football, more than for good Mexican food, or whatever it happens to be that turns you on. If Jesus is your number one priority, if you want more than anything to go to heaven, you can and you will go there. That's the only way you're going to go. And we encourage you to do whatever it takes to make that right with God today while we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.